For the next few minutes on WGTD's morning show, we explore the Erie Canal and its fascinating history. And I must admit right off the bat that before reading this book at least, amazingly, absurdly ignorant of just exactly what the Erie Canal was. As I began reading this book, it became very clear to me that I couldn't tell you where the Erie Canal was. I mean, I knew it was in New York State. I knew it probably had something to do with Lake Erie, but I had no idea how long it was or exactly what two points it connected, and knew next to nothing about its history, except for some mention of it made in a recent biography of our fifth president, James Monroe. And so my curiosity was already a bit piqued at that point, and fully satisfied by an incredibly thorough, comprehensive examination of the Erie Canal and its long, tumultuous road towards construction and completion. The book is called Bond of Union, Building the Erie Canal and the American Empire. The book is the result of the good work of Gerard Coppell, who has examined this very important undertaking from every imaginable vantage point, including the political work in the public eye and very much behind the scenes, which was necessary to make this all possible. And the result is an endlessly fascinating book, which really helps us understand the significance of the Erie Canal in really helping propel this new country forward. And I'm grateful to Gerard Coppell, who is also the author of Water for Gotham, for joining me today to talk about his book, Bond of Union, published by Da Capo Press, now in paperback. Gerard Coppell, we welcome you to the morning show.
Glad to be with you, Greg.
Would you tell us your sort of initial encounter with the fascinating story of the Erie Canal?
Ah, that's interesting. I was actually not intending to write this book. This book wasn't my idea. It started, I was getting ready to write a different book, and my agent happened to be having lunch with a publisher about another client of his books, and somebody during a break said, hey, Russ, my agent, Russ Galen, said to my agent, hey, Russ, you know somebody could write a book about the Erie Canal? And my agent said, well, yeah, I do, actually. This guy who wrote this book about New York City's water history a little while ago. And my agent called me up and said, Gerard, how about the Erie Canal? And my first response was, why? And I suppose I knew almost as little about the Erie Canal then as you did until recently. And I just thought the Erie Canal was something that had passed out of significance many, many decades or generations ago. And I knew that there had been many books written about it, that anywhere from third to fifth graders in most or many Northeastern schools learn about the Erie Canal. And I just wasn't, it didn't appear to me likely that people would really be interested in yet another book about the Erie Canal. But after doing some research and digging up some new stuff, I realized that the canal was a pretty significant thing, and that there were many new things to write about it.
By the way, and in some ways it would have been ideal for me to ask this question first, I should ask you also, what got you interested in what ultimately became the subject of your book, Water for Gotham? You've just touched on that briefly, but that seems like an even less likely topic for a book, at least to someone who doesn't live in New York City.
Yeah, well, the water book, nobody had written a book about New York City water before, incredibly. You'd think that, you know, in a city of 8 million, that somebody would have written a book about the city's water history, but nobody had when I did. That book started with, it was during the summer. I don't remember the specific summer now. But I sat down in front of a building on Park Avenue, the Seagram Building, designed by Mies van der Rohe, with plaza fountains in front of it. And I thought, my God, this is, I think, an August day. It is ridiculously hot, noisy, and dirty. And I sat down next to these plaza fountains, and the noise of the city melted away, the heat of the city melted away. And I thought, I think I was looking for a job then, or I don't remember exactly what I was doing, but I was walking around the city a lot. And I thought, you know, if I'm going to be doing this, why don't I try to find out where other water fountains are, other display fountains are, so I can find a nice, cool place to take a break. And over a period of time, that developed from finding out where the fountains are to finding out where the water for them came from, and eventually writing a book about it.
Wow. Well, that's a book I'm going to seek out because I am very, very intrigued. And, of course, in this day and age now where we see all around the world increasing shortages of water and perhaps a deepening appreciation of just how significant water is to our well-being, it's going to be interesting to learn about this particular story.
Right.
Back to the Erie Canal. And, of course, to the extraordinary difference which it makes. And I'm so glad that you paint for us a richly detailed picture of the young United States of America at a point when so much of what now is fully civilized was then a largely untouched frontier. Describe for us especially the sort of barrier which Mother Nature had, in effect, erected between the heavily populated, relatively heavily populated East Coast and what lay beyond. What was that barrier all about, and what did it mean to find a way to, in a sense, penetrate it?
Well, it's very difficult for Americans now probably to imagine the country as never having been a continental entity. That stretched, you know, from sea to shining sea. In the early days of the nation, and obviously during colonial times before that, but in the early days of the nation was restricted to essentially the eastern seaboard, because intervening between the lowlands of the eastern seaboard and the vast continental interior were the Appalachian Mountains, which run from Georgia all the way up to Maine. There are different names for the ranges, you know, in that long 2,000-mile run. But without any technology to get over those mountains, United States was potentially going to be restricted to its eastern seaboard. And in the early 1800s, west of the Appalachians, were all sorts of interests competing for claims to portions of that land. You had French, initially French, but then, still actually some French influence in the middle of the country, so around where you are, native interests, and Spanish interests, even Russian interests in the Pacific Northwest. And it was entirely unclear in the early 1800s just to what extent the United States was going to eventually run. And excuse me one second.
Mm-hmm.
As the nation began to develop, you know, through the late 1700s and then into the early 1800s, it became clear to the various states that whichever state managed to get west first was going to benefit greatly from it, from being essentially the state with the pioneering connection or the pioneering bond of union, the name of the book, which was a term that was used very often then, which state was going to dominate the nation by becoming the first one to reach over the Appalachian Mountains.
And I think we should probably make sure we're clear here that we're not talking about a given state sort of, I don't think you mean this primarily, sort of extending its political reach the way, for instance, this new nation was acquiring new territory, but you mean which state would house within its borders that sort of pathway or gateway through the mountains and past them, through which and on which and in which commerce could travel.
Right, exactly. I'm sorry if I wasn't clear. But basically, the way west was limited to rivers. And the states that had rivers that somehow managed to get or to originate up in the Appalachians but be low enough to possibly afford transportation on those rivers, that was the way to go. And make a long story short, New York and Virginia were the two states that had really the most intense competition. And Virginia had the Potomac River. Unfortunately, it was a too lowly for the task, because it really peters out quite quickly in the mountains just west of coastal Virginia. New York was lucky, basically an accident of geography. There's a break in the Appalachians, running through the middle of New York State, just south of, just a little bit north of Albany, the state capital. And that break is the Mohawk River, the Mohawk River Valley, which in its passage from its connection at Albany with the Hudson River goes up only about 500 feet or so before it gets through to the western part of the state. And 500 feet, compared with the thousands of feet of Appalachian Mountains further south, was a doable thing, although it didn't originally appear so, because when people started talking about a canal from the eastern part of the state to the western part of the state, most other people thought that was fairly insane.
Explain for a moment why there was the notion in the first place of constructing a canal. I mean, of what made these waterways that were already there from this accident of nature, why that wasn't sufficient for what we are talking about.
What happened with the Mohawk River, and this was the way that New York State found its way west, it originates about the middle of the state at a town called Rome, New York. And it's relatively meanders around there in the middle of New York State, and with relatively little water, becomes a fairly substantial river further east as it gets closer to the Hudson River. But west of that, through the western half of New York State, there's very little water. And that is why, one of the reasons why, building a canal through there seemed like such a fantastic idea when it originally came up.
One of the most interesting things about this whole story is that although canals had been constructed for centuries, and you tell us something about that, about the construction of canals around the world, this possibility was emerging in our nation at a time when we scarcely had a single soul who really had any kind of the deep background necessary or to have amassed any of the expertise that you would ideally have for construction of something like this. Tell us a little bit about that particular facet of this story.
In the early 1800s, there is no engineering education in the United States. There's West Point, which teaches some military engineering, for military purposes, but there's no education in civil engineering. There's there's no way for somebody to learn how to build a canal. And of course, railroads don't come along till the 1830s or so, but in the very earliest 1800s, the only people that might have any idea about how to build a canal are surveyors. People who whose main occupation in country settings is laying out boundary lines, laying out property lines, and they have sort of rudimentary knowledge of surveying instruments, which are used to figure out levels of land,
And that's crucial, of course, in the construction of canals.
Exactly. And these are the guys that first take up the challenge of building canals, of building American canals.
For those of you just joining us, we're speaking with Gerard Coppell, and we're talking about his book, Bond of Union, Building the Erie Canal and the American Empire. For just a moment, let's step back in history. You tell us that modern canal engineering was actually created back in the 1480s by Leonardo da Vinci. So that would be, in that era, some of the first examples of what we would recognize as canals. The way you describe that suggests that there were even earlier canals constructed in very different fashion. Can you just briefly summarize for us the essential function of a modern canal? I mean, what sort of has to be in place in order for a canal to be constructed?
Before Da Vinci, in Europe, there were some pretty substantial canals, but they were all essentially at the same level. So these canals were dug, snaking all around to maintain a level, because they didn't really know how to build a good lock. And a lock is a structure that essentially moves water from one level to the next. And probably hard to describe on radio, but a lock is essentially a step, like a step in a staircase, that moves water from one level to the next. And the thing that Da Vinci did that was essential is he figured out the best technology, a technology that's still used, for the gates of a lock. And he figured out mitered lock gates, which are gates that essentially don't move straight up and down or swing or are perpendicular to the rectangular structure of a lock. But he figured out to use mitered lock gates, which are gates essentially one gate on each side, and they meet at a V. And hard to describe this briefly, but essentially it makes the way the water flows in and out of the lock with pressure on those gates, mitered lock gates work. I'm not sure I know how to explain it very briefly.
Right, but no, that gives us some sense, though, that it was a much more efficient and dependable way to construct these locks, and thus you can have lengthier canals, I suppose, in more inhospitable places.
Most importantly, you can have canals that can pass through country at different levels. So you can, if you want to get from place A to place B, and place B is 200 feet higher than place A, you can put in a series of locks, maybe eight, that change the elevation 8 to 10 feet, and you can get from A to B using locks.
So when a canal is built, it requires that there already are rivers of some sort in place, and in some cases, I suppose it means the connecting of maybe two different rivers at some point.
Initially, rivers were only used to supply water for the canals next to them. Technology is very different now, and we understand how to use rivers as canals themselves. But in the early days of canal building, rivers were too unpredictable. They had droughts, they had floods, and you couldn't rely on them for actual traffic, for actual canal boat traffic. And so rivers were used, feeders were made from the rivers to feed the canal, which might be laid right alongside the river or within the margin of its valley.
Remind me, the Erie Canal, I don't believe, is the very first canal built in the new United States.
When the Erie Canal was built, then if we want to go through some numbers, it's and you were asking, you were saying before you had no idea originally where the Erie Canal ran between, and it's as easy as A to B, Albany to Buffalo.
And 363
miles, only 40 feet wide, only 4 feet deep, but that was enough. But when the Erie Canal was built, 363 miles, there were a total of maybe 100 miles of canals in the entire country. And most of those were 2 or 3 mile canals, private canals on private land. They were certainly not significantly engineered things. And the only substantial canal was the 27-mile Middlesex Canal in Massachusetts, which linked the Merrimack River and effectively Boston Harbor. And that canal was an absolute bear to build. It took about 12 years, went notoriously over budget, had terrible engineering issues, maintenance issues. But it eventually became a successful and prosperous canal. But that was initially when folks were talking about building an Erie Canal, people would point to the Middlesex Canal and say, you want to do something like that?
That probably is what prompts the words of a historian. You quote George Rogers Taylor saying, the building of the Erie Canal was an act of faith. I mean, by no means could any intelligent person say that all of this was a foregone conclusion to be a success. I wonder if you could speak for a moment also about something which develops or emerges kind of in the beginning of this story, well before ground is broken for the Erie Canal, and that is the emergence of the steamboat. You make such an interesting observation about this when you say the steamboat in 1807 gave hope for connectedness, but illustrated the lack of it.
You know, steamboat first goes into operation in 1807 on the Hudson River in New York City, and within a year or so is making runs between, and this is Robert Fulton's boat, between New York City and Albany, up and down the Hudson River. They're not very, very reliable machines at that point. They do become so relatively quickly. And then steamboats appear on the Mississippi River, also through Fulton and others connected to him. But there is no way for these boats to navigate between those two areas.
Between, for instance, the Hudson River and the Mississippi River.
Exactly.
You can't get from here to there.
Exactly. And these boats were not substantial enough to go out in open waters, in the ocean, you know, for a number of years beyond their original appearance. And there was no way to have a connection between the Mississippi and the Hudson.
Hmm. And, of course, it is only people of great vision who can really fully comprehend the gigantic difference it would make in this new emerging nation if somehow one could achieve this connectedness. And it is so interesting to examine those visionaries who each play varying roles in the emergence of this. I wonder if you could talk for a moment about the really interesting story of Jesse Hawley and his pseudonym Hercules. What, for instance, what role he plays in the very earliest chapter of this story of the Erie Canal.
So Jesse Hawley is from a family in Connecticut. They've been there for generations, since the middle 1600s. And he decides, I guess he's sort of tires of Connecticut, looking for something different. And he heads off to western New York in the area of Canandaigua. Maybe your listeners may not be familiar with that, but it's sort of in the middle of western New York. And at that point, it is a pretty substantial frontier territory. Aren't too many people living there. There are the first pioneer farmers, who are mostly subsistence farmers. And he moves out to western New York with the idea of becoming the first grain merchant of western New York. And his idea is to buy up farmers, mostly wheat, have it milled at the first mill in western New York on the Seneca River, which is a relatively small river in western New York, and then ship the milled flour by either road or the tangle of natural waterways through western New York that eventually lead to the Mohawk, the beginning of the Mohawk River in the center of New York. And he tries this for about a year or so, and then this first grain merchant of western New York becomes the first failed grain merchant of western New York, because he finds there really is no effective way to ship things from just in western New York, let alone further west in the western part of the continent, but just even from western New York, a couple of hundred miles east to the Hudson River.
Even that's just a logistical nightmare.
Impossible. Pretty much impossible. There are relatively few roads. The roads that there are ill-built. They are deeply rutted in winter. They flood out in the spring, et cetera, et cetera. The natural waterways are sort of a tangle of creeks and small rivers that are subject to drought and flooding. And he goes broke. He has a partner in Albany who walks off with their partnership's money, which doesn't help matters. He flees to flees the law to Pennsylvania for a little bit, but then a guilty conscience brings him back to western New York, where he is thrown in debtor's prison for 18 months, which is not the miserable experience of urban debtor prisons, which some of your listeners may know about. This is the second floor of the only hotel in Canandaigua, New York, and the hotel is run by the sheriff. And in any case, he is basically confined to his room there for 18 months, and he thinks, how can this be done better? And make a long story short, he, under a pseudonym, Hercules, has published in the local weekly newspaper 18 essays on originating the idea of building a canal across the breadth of New York State. And that is essentially up or along the Mohawk River Valley in the eastern part of the state, and then cutting across the western part through an area that has very little water, except just enough small rivers and creeks to supply a canal, and bring that canal to Buffalo on Lake Erie. And once you meet Buffalo on Lake Erie, and again, Buffalo is not the city it is now. Buffalo then was a settlement of about a couple of hundred people. But once you reach this settlement at the eastern end of Lake Erie, you are then connected to all of the other Great Lakes, except for Lake Ontario, which is north. And that way you can really get into the center of the continent, to where you are, to where Detroit was, a small settlement there, to where Chicago would be, and ultimately on to the center of the continent. He publishes these essays under a pseudonym because, of course, if he had published under his own name, readers would know that he was a jailed bankrupt and would pay even less attention to this fantastic idea. And his identity is actually protected for about 20 years until he reveals it himself at a time when the canal is nearing completion and he can fairly take up a hero's mantle.
One of the things that's so intriguing is that as you describe some of these early years when there are a few visionaries who begin to embrace this possibility, you will often use the term canal-minded. There was a meeting of some canal-minded individuals, which of course demonstrates that there were plenty of Americans, probably most Americans, who were not canal-minded, or maybe who just couldn't get their heads around this whole notion, let alone a canal which would be of such unprecedented length and complexity. But beyond, I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
But beyond that problem was also the matter of a deep political divide, which sprang up around all kinds of different specific issues and questions and concerns. But the Erie Canal is a wonderful example of this early conundrum in our country of states' rights versus a strong federal government and this whole notion of the common good. Speak for a moment about this political problem with something like the Erie Canal.
So So it's all fine and good to have an idea to build a canal 363 miles across a largely uninhabited state where there are no people who, very few people live. There's certainly very little technology or advanced technology to build such a thing. But then more important than that is, where does the money for it come from? And early 1800s America is not a highly, you know, capitalistic place. It's a place of relatively few and small cities, and most of the country is largely rural farmers, subsistence farming for the most part. So where does the money come to build such a such a canal? The place you look first is the federal government. But the federal government then, certainly not now, but then is largely constrained by constitutional concerns about states' rights and about the right, as opposed to the duty. And I think now the federal government has a duty to put money out for infrastructure projects. But then there was a significant concern that the federal government didn't have the right to use federal money for state projects. And so when the first folks who were thinking about the Erie Canal in New York State go down to Washington on any several occasions, they are turned away. And Congress and the president, first President Jefferson, and after him his protege, James Madison, they both say to New York, look, there is no federal authority to provide money for your project.
And, of course, part of this issue is that you have congressmen from South Carolina and Georgia that cannot begin to understand or are extremely skeptical of the notion that somehow they and their citizenry would benefit from the Erie Canal up in New York State. I mean, this seemed like entirely sort of a state matter. And it was hard for them, probably for most Americans, to understand how this could make a difference for all Americans.
You know, the federal government was funding some things like lighthouses, which, you know, arguably there's a national interest in safe shipping. And the federal government got involved in some roads in certain areas. And arguably, the Louisiana Purchase in 1804 by Jefferson was not a constitutional thing, because what was the federal government doing making land purchases like that? But there would, I'm sorry, I lost my train of thought.
We're talking about the how the Erie Canal seems to have been something that was not as attractive as some of these other things that you were talking about.
And I'm sorry about that.
No problem.
But it appeared to people, to Congress and to Jefferson and to Madison, who were not New Yorkers, that while this Erie Canal might be a great idea that would help the nation get west, it was also an idea that was going to substantially benefit New York to the exclusion of the rest of the country.
Hmm.
And that's why the federal dollars did not go to New York for Erie Canal. And when that possibility was finally shut off, when President Madison vetoed a bill that would have provided money for a number of projects around the country, he finally vetoed that bill on his last day in office in 1817. Instead of New York saying, oh, well, that's it, they instead, the New York State Legislature, decided to build a canal themselves with only with New York money, and that money was raised largely by bonds. And these are a novel idea, obviously. Now everybody buys munis, but in 1817, munis were a pretty novel concept. And the canal was largely funded by Erie Canal bonds at 5 or 5.5% interest, plus an array of fees and tolls.
Hmm. By the way, I was intrigued by a point in the book when you said that in some respects the long fight to bring this into reality, I mean, before one spade of dirt has been turned on behalf of this new canal, at one point you said something to the effect that it probably worked out for the best in the end, that this canal did not go forward much earlier when some of the first concerted efforts were made, because in those early days there is no way that America could have afforded this, and probably a lot of the money that would have been put into the construction of the Erie Canal would have come from foreign sources, and that might have made all of this a lot more complicated. Do I remember that correctly?
Yeah, basically that's right. I mean, I don't know if we mentioned it. Jesse Hawley, who has who goes bankrupt in Western New York. That's about 1805, 1806. He writes his essays in 1807. Everybody starts getting excited around 1809, 1810, as his essays start spreading around. New York State names a canal commission to look into this. They're kind of getting excited about it, and then boom, 1812, War of 1812. That shuts the whole canal idea down for a number of years. And then finally, after the War of 1812 ends, around late 1815, or in 1815, then people start thinking about it again. Certain people who were involved in the effort, who had some impractical ideas about how the canal should be built, they pass from the scene. And around 1816, you have the ultimate champion of the Erie Canal finally rise to the top of the organization of the project, and that is DeWitt Clinton, who was a leading New Yorker and becomes governor in 1817. But it is through this long process of Clinton got involved in about 1810, and the original plans go nowhere, the war, and then finally after the war, Clinton is in a position as governor and also as the head of the Canal Commission just previous to that to have learned from all these false starts during the previous period and then actually figure out how to get the thing funded and built.
So in some respects, although it had to be frustrating for certain champions of this canal project, that in fact it was almost certainly worth the wait, and had it gone forward earlier, it would have been probably a misguided project. One thing that, of course, complicated the story was that there were competing ideas about what this canal should look like, specifically a couple of competing ideas about its route, one more involved with, I think, Lake Ontario than Lake Erie, and then another question about whether or not this should be an inclined canal. Can you just briefly explain those matters?
Well, those are the two issues that really hung things up, you know, for the first decade or so. And as to the route, the Jesse Hawley's essays proposed in a so-called interior route. Everybody agreed on the eastern section. That was along the Mohawk River Valley from Albany up to the middle of the state at Rome, New York. But then the next 200 miles west, that to reach Lake Erie, how do we do that? Hawley said you go overland and basically through the western part of the state using the water sources that are there, creeks, streams, small rivers. Other people said you go straight from Rome via a couple of natural waterways up to the eastern end of Lake Ontario. And then you go along Lake Ontario, which leads west, and then you find a way around Niagara Falls, and then down into, and then up into Lake Erie. Now, that was a major debate. Ultimately, the so-called interior route won out because of a few concerns. If you use Lake Ontario and you have a shipment of goods on a canal boat coming along the eastern section, then you've got to transship those goods to a lake boat, meaning, you know, canal boats are kind of big barges. They don't work well on lakes. So you'd have to take everything out of a canal boat somewhere on the eastern end of Lake Ontario, at Oswego is the town, put the goods into a boat that is good for lake travel, meaning a keel draft boat, and then go sail along to the western end of Lake Ontario, once again transship in some way to some form of transportation to get around Niagara Falls, and then finally down into Lake Erie. So that is expensive and time-consuming. Also, Lake Ontario itself is somewhat storm-ravaged, so you have risk there. And Lake Ontario, of course, was shared by the United States on the south side and British Canada on the north side. And the War of 1812 gave a pretty good reason why having a canal that relied on Lake Ontario was not such a good idea. And so eventually, the so-called interior route won out. That was the first issue. The next issue was what type of canal. And the initial fellow who was in charge of the New York State Canal Commission, a guy named Gouverneur Morris, fascinating guy, we probably don't have time for him, but his idea was that the canal should be built on an inclined plane, which means that at Buffalo, which is roughly 575 feet higher than Albany, the canal should start there and then run on a very gentle slope all the way from Buffalo down to Albany, essentially spilling the water of Lake Erie into the canal and using it all the way to Albany. It sounds like an interesting idea, but Gouverneur Morris didn't fully understand is that in several spots, intervening spots in that route, there is not a continuous descent of 575 feet. In some places, there's a very rapid descent, deep valleys, and then rises. And so what you would have is in certain places, you might have this canal 175 feet in the air over a low valley in order to maintain that decline from Buffalo down to Albany. And especially in the area of Syracuse, which now a major New York State city, then there wasn't really much there. It was just the beginnings of a little hamlet. Imagine if you had a 175-foot wall essentially running through what became Syracuse. Well, you probably wouldn't have had Syracuse. In any case, the folks who understood better that the best way to build a canal is with locks and levels, meaning level stretches of canal, and then locks, as we talked about earlier, to negotiate elevation changes, that was the most intelligent way to do this. Hmm.
Ultimately, as construction at last gets underway, you describe something that really surprises us, and that is what the groundbreaking ceremony was like, and I believe it was 1817. I mean, very much a quiet, remote event, lightly publicized, scarcely at all, in fact. I mean, an inauspicious beginning to what ultimately was an amazing undertaking.
In 1817, when groundbreaking happens, everybody says that DeWitt Clinton, the incoming governor and champion of the Erie Canal, that he was there to turn the first spadeful of dirt. This is wrong. He was not. He was in New York City. He didn't necessarily want to be associated with this just yet because it was unclear whether the state really had whether the bonds for the canal were going to sell, whether they had the technology to actually, you know, blast away rock that needed to be blasted away and muck out swamps to form canal walls, et cetera, et cetera. And so, yes, the groundbreaking was relatively little attended and significantly underreported. And with one note, the enabling legislation for the state enabling legislation to actually authorize the beginning of construction, every New York City state legislator in Albany voted against the enabling legislation, which is astounding because the greatest beneficiary of the Erie Canal, of course, was New York City. because goods went essentially from New York City up the Hudson River and then along the canal. And all of the New York merchants of New York City became fantastically wealthy because of their place in what eventually became the route of goods, imported goods coming through New York, going up the canal, going up the Hudson, and out west along the canal, and then raw materials coming east along the canal, down the Hudson, and to New York City, where they were sold out to the rest of the world. New York City merchants in 1817 thought the canal was an upstate boondoggle, and they thought it was going to fail, and that they, in New York City, would be taxed to pay for this boondoggle. And so that is why the groundbreaking in 1817 was a relatively low-key affair.
You know, as you describe all that, we realize anew that due to all of the political opposition to this notion and kind of a general bewilderment among much of the population not even understanding all this, and the logistical challenges involved in actually constructing this in this new country with almost nobody with the full expertise required. I mean, it's nothing short of a miracle and a marvel that the Erie Canal ultimately takes shape, and we can follow its construction and every detail of that long process in your book as well. I want us to finish, though, in our last minute or so, with this quotation from Alexander Hamilton, which actually was used anonymously at one point as they were fighting to pass legislation to create the Erie Canal. These earlier words about Alexander Hamilton were quoted: "Everything tending to establish substantial and permanent order in the affairs of a country, to increase the total mass of industry and opulence, is ultimately beneficial to every part of it." Did the Erie Canal ultimately prove that to be true?
The Erie Canal showed that it could be done. And once New York had made a great success out of the Erie Canal, other states started throwing lots of money at canals. Some of them were not very successful. Some of them were. I think also the canal spurred development of railroads, which were just beginning to come in. But people saw that by risking time and money to create great things, the payoff was substantial. And I think it's, in the country now we have a great challenge. I'm not sure how much new infrastructure we're going to build, although there's certainly areas where we should, but our current infrastructure is falling apart. And, there's a lot of talk amongst the infrastructure chorus about how the Erie Canal was the first great thing we built, and should demonstrate to us the importance of putting money into infrastructure rebuilding and building. And I'm not sure we're there yet as a country.
You say New York's canal makers were the first humans to substantially change what nature had made. This amazing story, Bond of Union, Building the Erie Canal and the American Empire, is a paperback from DaCapo Press, the author Gerard Coppell. Gerard Coppell, I thoroughly enjoyed your book, learned so much, and I'm glad we could talk about your book today on The Morning Show. Thank you so much.
Greg, thank you.